From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll look ahead to the Sustainability Summit opening today in Milwaukee. Then, in a city known for its breweries, the latest is cooking up mobile apps.
Barriers to entry to being a software developer have all but gone away. You pay, I think, $100 to Apple, you pay, whatever to Google, and you're able to be a player in the market.
Plus, how Germans first started brewing beer in Milwaukee. It's maple sugaring season in Wisconsin, and the challenges of launching a video series on veggies.
One time we did a segment in here about storing your canning lids and rings. A two-minute segment took us 2 hours and two nights to get it right.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This morning at the Wisconsin Center in downtown Milwaukee, the 11th annual Sustainability Summit gets underway. The three-day event organized by Milwaukee Area Technical College brings together people from environmental, academic, government, and the corporate worlds. This year, the conference is focusing on two aspects of sustainability: sustainable business and sustainable energy. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz reports on what the disparate interests represented at the conference all get out of being a part of it.
So the first person I'm talking with is Jessica Cahotas. Do you want to introduce us to you, Jessica?
Yeah, hi, I'm Jessica Cahotas. I'm the president of Transition Milwaukee. Transition Milwaukee specifically is about a ground-up movement towards sustainability. So we have access to over 200 grassroots and nonprofit organizations currently working for bottom-up solutions towards all elements of sustainability. And so we would actually like to have them represented at the summit, because that is a major part of sustainability, is having an engaged community, showing the efforts and also celebrating them as well. I did present last year. I was on a panel of speakers, including Marsha Caton Campbell from Center for Resilient Cities and Karen Sands from MMSD. And we presented on what resiliency is versus sustainability. And the reactions from the room, people wanted to hear more. They understood that creating resiliency means that you reduce the geography in which you're working. So people are automatically more engaged. The changes that you make are more tangible to the sustainability of your local area. And so next year I would actually like to speak a little more to that.
What can you draw from this kind of event? I mean, it's just one more meeting?
No, not at all. It's great to hear examples of people who have been successful, organizations who have been successful at fighting climate action, at working towards sustainability on a global scale. Now, what I'd like to suggest that we need to work towards is scaling back and working for our immediate surroundings. And so we have to take these single issue examples and then apply them to a smaller scale. And that's what we're talking about.
Matthew Rockte with the Milwaukee Sustainability Roundtable.
Okay, tell me about the roundtable.
We are gathering all the region's largest companies and their sustainability leaders and corporate social responsibility leaders to find ways to collaborate and make Milwaukee more sustainable.
How's that going?
We had our first roundtable at the beginning of this month with Manpower Group, and it was outstanding.
What is this kind of gathering coming up over these next few days? What's the value of it, do you think?
Continually educating everybody about what's going on, what's possible, where are the opportunities. It's not all about conservation, not all about being green. It's about looking at where are the opportunities. How can we come together to collaborate? How can we come together to make things happen? It will be the conversations I have in between things, finding out, hey, do you know about this activity that's going on? Do you know about this event? Do you know about, hey, they're doing some really cool things. Why don't I drag you over there and go talk to you? I think that's a lot for most conferences. I mean, some people go for the conference for the speakers. I tend to go for those conversations in between.
I'm Jesse Willard, and I am a Marquette student. I'm a sophomore, and I work for a company called Gas Day that is here at Marquette.
What do you find compelling about this summit? What do you think it could do for you?
I think the summit is a really great networking tool for students. It really teaches us to branch out and reach out to adults, I think, because that's sometimes intimidating to come up to a stranger that you've never met and introduce yourself and kind of sell yourself and your story and why you're here. So I think that's a great thing for students to be doing.
What's your trajectory?
My trajectory is, I'm thinking about patent law personally, but I think the environment itself, I want it to be around for generations. So the more conferences that we support now, the better off we'll be in the future, I think. This money and everything is really important.
Your full name, please.
Okay, I'm Nathan Nissen. I work at Kohler, and I'm working on our footprint reduction projects. So I'm coordinating energy conservation, greenhouse gas reduction, water conservation, and waste reduction as well. So I'm trying to work with the whole company globally to help them reduce their own environmental footprint.
How long have you been on board?
25 years next month.
Do you really think that tangible outcomes can come out of this kind of a gathering?
Yes, absolutely. I can prove it. Because of the networking, the people. The last conference I went to, I met Robert Noble from Noble Technologies, and they make a product called E-Core, which is a cradle-to-cradle certified product that's really made out of fiber and heat and pressure. And they make this fibrous product that you can use to make products with. Well, now we're talking with them about using their material in our materials. So, and also we're talking with them about using some of our waste materials as a raw material for their company. So the last conference I was at with this really paid a big dividend, where we had some good connections that haven't paid off yet, but I can see the path, I can see a road. There's certainly a road, and the question is, can we get the truck to drive down the road? But we'll work together and try to make it work. Yeah.
Oh, I'm Caroline Villa, mechanical engineering student here at Marquette.
Oh, what year?
I'm a junior.
So you're standing before this display because?
I'm actually a member of the Engineers Without Borders group here on Marquette's campus, and the Sustainability Summit kind of reached out to us to come in and kind of put our posters up, show how we help communities with reused materials, renewable sources, as well as kind of like how it impacted the community.
So is this summit part of your annual vocabulary?
This is actually the second year I've heard about it, but I think it's really cool what the Sustainability Summit does, and especially allowing students to go for free. I'm a mechanical engineering student, so I kind of do the sustainability and seeing like water and like how to help communities on the side, but I think just being able to go to those resources is phenomenal and just great.
So are you looking for something in particular this year, or will you be tied to a display board?
I think I'm going to be tied to the display board, sadly. But just like being around everyone and just kind of talking and hearing their stories is really cool and kind of why I like coming back.
So the sustainability theme, as they spoke about, you know, what this is all about, what does it speak to you in your career and your life?
And seeing that, like, across globally, like, there's a need for water, there's a need for, like, good resources. It's, like, giving back to, like, future generations. And I think that's something that we all can participate in and really, like, make a difference.
What do you think you might be doing after school?
Hopefully, I just want a job. To be honest, I just want a job. But I really want to be able to, like, work at a company that is, like, giving back and really, like, doing a social push with sustainability and like sustainable resources overall.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. The 11th annual Sustainability Summit opens this morning at the Wisconsin Center in downtown Milwaukee. A new brewery is open and producing things in Milwaukee, but not so much beer. We're talking mobile apps, and we'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. In the history of communications, it has not been an especially long time since telephones were all wired to the wall and our ability to reach out and touch someone by phone was limited. Today, not only can we call anyone from virtually anywhere, but for many of us, our phones have capabilities that were unheard of on a desktop computer a decade ago. And a Milwaukee laboratory is making a significant contribution to the landscape of mobile app development. What makes it especially impressive is that the developers are students. The so-called App Brewery at UW-Milwaukee has been up and running for more than a year. Michael Hostad is Director of Web and Mobile Services at UWM, and he joins us to share the story of the App Brewery. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. I appreciate it.
How does the work of the App Brewery fit in with the overall educational mission of a place like UW-Milwaukee?
Well, I think kind of what makes the App Brewery a little bit unique, although this is happening all over UWM, is that we're focused on taking the education, the learning that's happening in the classroom and applying it to a real-world sort of setting. So the App Brewery partners with nonprofits, with local government, with startups, with researchers, of course, to give the students something that they can take their skills that they learned in the classroom and use it towards something real. And they actually get to interact with clients and learn the whole process. So it's, become really that extension of the classroom into something that the students can really see how their skills can impact people, can affect an organization.
It's no longer theoretical when they walk
right.
into the brewery.
We always Quinn Madsen, who's our lead developer and one of the instructors, always joked that a lot of programming classes they're real apt to saying, well, let's create a mortgage calculator, and it's like, well, students, what is a mortgage calculator, and why do I have to understand amortization tables and all that sort of stuff? So we wanted to give them something that they could put to use and be applicable in a setting.
Well, I'll paint a picture of exactly what the lab is and what sorts of background they bring to that work.
Well, and that's the interesting thing. So we've got just to give you a little bit of background, we started a little over a year ago last February, and we started with 4 students. We now have 12, and we've just gotten the go-ahead to hire up to 20. And it's students from all different backgrounds. We've got information studies students. We've got graphic design students. We've got a couple of communications students. And what we're trying to do is build sort of an agency field of what we're doing. We want the students to understand that they are part of a team and that their skills interact with the skills of a designer or a developer or a project manager and get them to see how multiple people bring certain skills to working on one project and show them how to work together as a team to build whatever it is that they're building for our clients.
So these aren't just students that are rock stars in code that come to you.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what makes it unique is that we've got a lot of students from a lot of different backgrounds. And it's one of the things that we have to tell students, you don't have to be a coder. You don't have to be that IT person. You can bring creativity to the table. You can bring organization and project management to the table. You can bring communications to the table. So we really try to bring in many different aspects to the brewery.
There are a lot of organizations, a lot of companies with a lot of needs in terms of apps. What kind of work is the right fit for your lab?
We really have been focusing – we started our focus on the nonprofit sector. We've worked with a number of organizations who, without the help of the App Brewery, frankly, probably wouldn't be able to do some of the things that they're doing with mobile. So that's been a good fit for us. But we really like to take on projects that excite the students, that give them something to really work towards and be excited about. Because after all, it's about the students. We want to give them unique opportunities not only to broaden their skill set but also try and get them connected into the community, and that's where the nonprofit world has really come into play. We've expanded into, of course, researchers at both UWM and now the Medical College of Wisconsin, and so that's providing another layer of interaction for students to get involved with.
Well, and for most of us whose connection connection to this world comes through an icon on our mobile device. Can you walk us through the app development process? What happens and how does it happen?
Well, it always starts with an idea. And it's amazing, you know, with the advent of mobile, some of the ideas that people are coming up with is just incredible. So we listen to the idea. We figure out whether that's applicable for a mobile device. And then we usually start with a storyboarding process. And we literally just go through screen by screen and figure out, okay, when the user opens the app, what are they going to see? And when they click on this, what are they going to see? And what's the app going to do? Once the storyboarding process is set and finalized and approved, then the students start with the design and development and go from there. So there's testing in there and then finally client approval and we go live.
Well, one of the things that you have done just in recent days is look at pitches for medical apps. And I imagine you see these kinds of pitches all the time. What's your sense for what the best ideas for apps have in common today and where do things go wrong?
You know, I think in terms of the best ideas, it really ranges. We're starting to see a lot more centered around health. That can be sort of a scary world because you're dealing with health data and privacy information. So, you know, apps are just really starting to get more and more comfortable with that, people starting to develop in that world. But I see that as being a big thing. And then, you know, potential pitfalls just center around the data piece. Is the data being pulled in correctly? Is it secure? And does the app function? You know, in the world of Android, there's how many different devices? And so testing for that can be problematic. And if you don't do all of your homework and all of your testing and release an app that only works for a handful of people, that's not exactly the place you want to be in.
Well, and is this a source of frustration for people in your field when there's yet another device that comes onto the market, this concern that this thing that I've spent the last 3 months working on might not work on it?
Absolutely. And there's a whole slew of companies that are willing and able to help you to deal with that problem, but for a price, of course. So it's definitely a challenge. I mean, it's great that there's so many options for consumers, but for a developer, it provides some challenges.
Can you give us a sense for what some of the apps that have emerged through the work of the App Brewery are?
Sure. So we're working on a number right now. We're doing something for Visit Milwaukee where they can set up conferences. It's basically an app to promote the different conferences that are coming into town. So conferences can basically use the Visit Milwaukee app for their attendees to pull up the conference schedule, speaker bios, things like that. We've done something for the Sojourner Family Peace Center. We're working on an app for Historic Milwaukee that would allow you to take tours of the historic elements of Milwaukee and get a sort of a guided voice in your earbuds as you walk around the city. We're working on something for the Jewish Community Center. We're working with the Art Museum. Of course, our work with the Medical College. So the list, we've got about 30 active projects right now. So it keeps growing.
Well, and what strikes me about the app world is that years ago, we would be talking about software packages and you'd go to the computer store and you'd spend $59 or $99 or more on this box that came with a CD and an instruction manual. And with apps, you're paying a fraction of the cost for things that do an amazing array of tasks. How is the economic model allowing for the kind of innovation for places like the App Brewery? How are you able to accomplish that sort of thing without the high cost on the other end?
Well, a lot of apps are kind of going to what they call this freemium model, you know, where you get the app for free or for 99 cents. But, you know, if it's a game, for example, to advance to certain levels, you, of course, have to pay money to unlock things or get different tools in your arsenal for whatever game you're playing. So a lot of them kind of are going more towards this in-app purchase, and frankly, there's a lot of value in building something gigantic and hoping that somebody wants to buy it from you down the road. Now, you know, the likelihood of that is, debatable. But I think, you know, there's examples of it everywhere, the amount of value that people place into these things. So it's really a matter of having that idea and the execution of that idea that's going to be what helps make you successful.
And presumably, you know, the distribution costs have basically gone away.
Right, exactly. There's no boxes that you have to print and no media that you need to print. It definitely – you know, barriers to entry to being a software developer have all but gone away. You pay, I think, $100 to Apple, you pay, you know, whatever to Google, and you're able to be a player in the market.
Is the sky the limit for the App Brewery right now? Are you able to you said you've grown from 4 to 12 employees. Mm-hmm. How much more growing can you do?
Well, Chancellor Lovell likes to say that he'd love to see 100 students in the lab. I haven't figured out if he's messing with me or not. But obviously we are trying to be, you know, purposeful in our growth and taking on projects that we can do. We don't want to get in over our heads because, again, this is about providing opportunities for the students. But so long as there's students that are passionate and interested in learning about this sort of work, we'll take them on and we'll show them. So we'd love to see it continue to grow.
What's the most exciting part of this stuff for you?
I said yesterday we had a pitch event at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and I said, I can't believe I get paid to do this. There's just some elements of this job that are incredibly fun. It's really getting to talk to our clients, listen to their ideas, and help them potentially realize those ideas. And so plus working with the students is just a wonderful experience. I'm amazed. We've got some really talented students that are absolutely brilliant and just a joy to be around. So it really makes coming to work fun.
Well, Michael Hostad, thank you so much for sharing the story of the App Brewery.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Michael Hostad is Director of Web and Mobile Services at UW-Milwaukee. There is a link to more about the App Brewery at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. From brewing apps to brewing beer, we go back in time to learn about Milwaukee's early brewery history when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Every summer, thousands of people come to Milwaukee to celebrate German Fest with a pint or two of Milwaukee's German-influenced beers. Milwaukee's beer barons, Pabst, Schlitz, Blatz, and Miller, have all made an impact in the city. They provided jobs for the community, and they gave back in the form of projects for the greater good. Today, Milwaukee residents attend games at Miller Park, shows at the Pabst Theater, and concerts at Eline Hall. But Milwaukee's first brewers were not German. They were Welsh. That's where Brenda McGee picks up in her recent book, Brewing in Milwaukee. Back in February, she told Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about the Welsh brewers that started Milwaukee's beer legacy.
During the 1800s, especially gearing towards the 1840s with the immigration, a lot of the immigration, there was a mixture of Europeans as well as British, and they had their ale that they were brewing. And it was a different flavor. It was a little bit weaker than German lager. And so during the next decade of immigration, there were more Germans dominated the development of the city. And seeing a need and not accustomed to the British drink, they felt that they could make an improvement. They could also cultivate their customer base, and they could make a lot of people more happy. So that was the difference in the way to brew the beer and the traditions behind it.
So then what attracted the Germans to Milwaukee?
It was quite a few things. There was the conditions at home in Europe. Potato famine also had some degree effect in Europe. There was just the government policies, which included registration for military, and they wanted their sons to not have to serve, so they might have sent them over to America. There was also new opportunities, and the state of Wisconsin had deliberately set out to invite immigrants, especially to Wisconsin. They delegated programming for them. They set out flyers, which gave all of the different assets of Wisconsin, inviting different people to come over, whether it be for logging, working in the factories, or whatever it might be. They dispersed these on the East Coast, as well as every language that was possible, and passed them out in Europe. So you see these postings, you think that there's opportunity, you'd like to go, you're the youngest son, you're maybe a widow or husband and father who needs to make a better life for his family. So they immigrate. So there were various reasons.
How did Milwaukee become famous for the brewing?
There were quite a few factors. We had, at the time of the becoming famous aspect of it, mm-hmm. we had the four breweries, which was Pabst, Schlitz, Blatz, and Miller. And it was one particular event in the city of Chicago, a wonderful neighbor to the south, mm-hmm. that actually propelled the city of Milwaukee into the limelight, and that was the Great Chicago Fire. The fire that roared for 3 days through wooden buildings devastated the city, including their drinking water and Lake Michigan. Polluting that, they had absolutely no way to get any beverage at all. They had no water. There were breweries in Chicago as well. They couldn't function because of the lack of pure water. It was actually Schlitz that said that he needed to step up and help his neighbors to the south in Chicago after the fire. And it was a twofold thought. One, again, helping a city that had been devastated. And two, it also was able to move his product. And it was a smart move on his part. And at that time, everybody drank beer. Mm-hmm. Women drank beer. Children drank beer. It was a beverage that, through history, has been able to sustain life for various reasons, and the biggest being that the water is boiled or the water is cooked, which allows for all the bacteria or the negative bacteria and other germs and stuff like that to be drawn out. So that movement for him and the thankfulness, the citizens of Chicago, when they remarked that Schlitz is the beer that made Milwaukee famous, was because of that. That he had gone out of his way to do this. He was helping another city. And so that was their response to it, that they were so appreciative of his goodwill and his gesture. That saying then again has been one that they used for marketing purposes, and it's what we know today.
And what I find really interesting while reading this is that the beer barons had such an amazing impact and presence in the city. It wasn't just breweries and beer cans and beer bottles, but they actually erected buildings and gave back to the community. Which beer baron had the biggest presence in Milwaukee?
Well, I think there's, if I could call it a tie, between Pabst and Schlitz or the Ealing family, I think it would have to be the two of them because they have contributed so much to the arts, to the social status of the city. All of the breweries in some way formed the idea of whom they wanted to service. In general, they wanted to service the whole city of Milwaukee. But they were patrons of specific areas. Most of them had their orphanages, and they had the Holy Sisters of some other type of organization. So as far as the social aspect of things that they contributed for, that was important to them, as well as giving back to the community in the form of arts and other organizations that benefited the citizens of Milwaukee. That was one thing that they had felt was important to them. The city had given to them their hard labor. The city had given to them their community. They had accepted them, and they wanted to give back in return. And so over time, we have all of these different contributions.
Then how did they treat their workers? Were the working conditions good quality or not as much?
I think that would have to be how you're looking at it. If you're looking at the decade of the 1880s, mm-hmm. to just say that it was adequate, you know, to judge how the workers were working, the facilities in which they worked in, the conditions in which they worked in, probably at the time would have been, you know, wonderful. If you look at some of the images that are in the book, you'll see that there are what look like hundreds of people in one particular department or area. But they're all doing assigned different tasks. And that given because of the technology that was available at the time. Mm-hmm. As technology progressed, you see that there were less and less individuals that are working the same departments because of technology. And I would say that conditions are, for each decade of business, I would think that the conditions would have changed, the work environment would have changed, as well as the requirements of the job would have changed. And so I think that individuals would say in the 1860s to the 1880s, it was great to have a job, no matter what it was. Mm-hmm. And each decade later, or each term later, everyone appreciative of their positions and their jobs. But again, there were different things that changed that. Organizing into labor unions, that happened early on. Having women organize in a labor union took a little bit longer to do that. Each of the departments, they were organized differently as far as not only the work environment, but how they were to progress. And for instance, women were highly regarded in the work field because of their agility and the fact that they were very dependable. They were able to do jobs that men couldn't do and vice versa. So the men had the jobs that needed to be more burlesome, heavier cask to take, whereas women had the jobs of cleaning the bottles perhaps, putting labels on bottles, things where their dexterity was highly valued.
One of the things I found interesting while reading this book is the mention of technology and how much of an impact these beer barons had. And one thing that I saw was that some of them actually used clay or ceramic bottles, and then they switched over to glass bottles. Why did they use ceramic bottles at first, and why did they change to glass bottles?
When you think about the technology and what was adaptable, if you see the ceramic bottles or jugs, I think would have been used all throughout Europe. And that is what they had to make their vessels. It was easier. You can just literally grab it out of the ground and mold these vessels to accommodate whatever the beverage or ingredient that you needed to put in there. And they not only could they keep the drink or the contents colder, that it was also prevented light to taint the ingredients. It would be easier to, they were quite heavy, so you could reuse them frequently. When they developed the glass bottle, it was developed because they had been, at that point, just before the glass bottles were introduced, they were transporting via kegs. And so whether it be wagon or on rail, there were many instances where the kegs would become broken and the product is then ruined. You can't sell it. You can't pick it up.
Right.
You can't do anything with it. So inventing and using a dark, again, dark to prevent the light from going through to the ingredient, as well as easier to use. So it's easier to handle. They're not quite as heavy. They're a little bit slimmer. As far as the size, it's a little bit easier to hold, easier to process through the factory as far as bottling and then packaging. So you've got two similar ingredients for the same purpose. They prevent the light as well as easier to handle and process.
So who was the first to bottle his beer then?
That would have been Blatt's Brewery. Again, he was interested in marketing. He wanted to reach as many cities as possible. And whether you're sending them via rail or through wagon, on a lot of occasions, they had their beer barrels would have been broken. And to save the product, to again, bottom line is essential, that he came up with a new idea to change what had previously been used as the clay bottles and go with a dark glass bottle. And so Blatt's has been known to be the first to bottle his beer.
And speaking of packaging, I am just curious, did Pabst ever actually win a blue ribbon?
No.
They never. No.
Everybody thinks that because they do have the ads and their marketing represent the blue ribbon. It's not. They did win quite a few gold medals that was given out at the World's Fair, but it was a marketing ploy that if you win the gold medal, you want people to notice it. You're not going to have the medals around. So to refer that same thought to the bottled ingredients, the bottled beer, you would tie these little ribbons around the neck of the bottle, and people would, curiosity would get the best of people, and they say, well, what's that? Well, the conversation might have been, well, that's the beer that won the gold medal. Well, I'll have that. I'll have that blue ribbon bottle. And so it just kind of caught on. It was a frequent saying and, again, another marketing ploy that worked.
Well, Brenda McGee, brewing in Milwaukee is going to create a lot of interest. So thank you so much for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much.
Brenda McGee is a historian at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. Her recent book is called Brewing in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson in February. Spring has been slow in coming this year, but that's actually good news for one crop, maple syrup. We'll talk maple sugaring with our outdoor adventure contributors when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. We can do a lot of things on Lake Effect, but unfortunately, we cannot equip your radio with smell-o-vision. That's unfortunate because we're going to spend a few minutes talking about maple sugaring season, which is perhaps the olfactory highlight of the early spring. And this is an especially good year for it, according to Lake Effect's outdoor adventure contributors, Ken Keffer and Stacy Tornio, who join us in the studio now. Great to see you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yep.
So we are in the heat of maple sugaring season, and you know, I think we have a general sense for what that means, but give us a working definition. What is the concept of maple sugaring actually mean?
Oh, well, maple sugar, you know, this is really exciting for me because this is the first season I've actually been involved in some maple tapping of my own. And so maple sugar season is pretty isolated. There's only kind of those northern tier of states that can get in on the action, and basically, it's the process of tapping those maple trees, getting that sap out, and then you have to boil that down to make syrup or sugar or candy out of it. And so it's that whole process, and it really is kind of exciting, fun times, and really sets the stage for that first warm days of the season.
Well, we'll talk about what makes it such an enjoyable activity.
Well, you think about it, and it's like, you know, I have kids, they're 10 and 8, and they have never seen maple sugaring. And it just seems like such a shame because it's like, this is such a cool thing that is happening right in our own backyard. You think it might be something that's happening in the country, but no, it's like right here in Milwaukee County, in the city, they're tapping maple trees and they're going to turn that into syrup. So just that basic concept of wanting to show kids how something comes from point A to point B, it's such a cool experience that they can really see for themselves.
Well, let's talk about the hands-on nature of it. What goes on in maple sugaring that people can really get up close and personal with?
The first thing you have to do is identify those maple trees. And it's easy if you're in the summer and you got those big maple leaves hanging out. You know, it's a little trickier in the winter.
This is an excellent point.
So you plan ahead. There's actually ways to tell in the winter, too, though, if you haven't, you know, marked those trees ahead of time. You can do it in your own backyard if you've got a maple tree back in there, and that sugar maple is the one you're really looking for. So the first step in it, though, is you have to drill a little hole in the side of the tree. And that's so you can get through that bark and get into the sapwood there and get the juices from the tree out, that sap out. And so you hammer a little spile in there, rhymes with smile, hammer that into the side of the tree, and that's your little drip-drip fountain. And so you collect that sap, and then you boil it down from there. And so it's really an interactive, and the thing about it is you need those warmer temperatures during the day and those colder temperatures at night, and that's what actually gets that sap flowing. And so these are the days you get to get out there and do it, and, you know, it's very hands-on, very active process.
Well, before you get any further, I grew up in the Northeast, and I remember the concept of the sugar shack where all this kind of chemistry went on. But from what you're describing, it sounds like even if you just have a maple tree in your backyard, this is an activity you can do.
For sure. You know, you can pick up the supplies. They're available around town. And yeah, anyone should be able to do that in their own backyard. You know, it's one of those things that it's kind of a heritage activity in nature, I think of it. You know, so generations, you know, get the grandparents involved and be like, well, when we were tapping trees, you know, and the technology, it's pretty simple technology still, but instead of having to, you know, hollow out an old sumac branch for your spile, you can use, you know, these metal ones now. And so it's really cool to reminisce back to the good old days of the sugar shacks too.
Well, and Stacy, let me ask ask you this because we hear a lot about bad things that can happen when insects get inside a tree. This does not harm the tree, drilling into the side of it?
No. I mean, that's what's so cool about it. It's like we have this resource that we should take advantage of. And, you know, if you're like – I've had this conversation with my kids and they kind of think of the maple syrup flowing from the tree, which is kind of funny if you think about it. But it really is a step-by-step process that – you know, what they have been doing for years and years, and we can do that. You know, we can do it ourselves. If you have the equipment, you can do that, and yeah, it doesn't harm the tree at all.
Can you get enough sap from a single maple tree to make an amount of maple syrup that would at least get you through one serving of pancakes?
Yeah, so when the sap flows out of the tree, it's just a really sweet water sort of flavor, and you have to cook that down. And the ratio, depending on the amount of sugar, but, you know, it's approximately 40 gallons of sap for 1 gallon of syrup. If you're not going to go for the full gallon, you're not in commercial, you know, production sale, you should be able to get enough, you know, from a single tree and be able to make a little at-home use. You know, you're not going to go in the maple sugar business, but, you know, you should be able to get some to last you through the season.
Well, and if I remember correctly, the best part of this whole process is what it smells like when you're doing this.
For sure. That maple, you know, just kind of permeates through and just really just sets the season for sure.
And I gather for people who do not have a maple tree in their yard, they don't necessarily need to break into somebody else's backyard. there are places like Weir Nature Center is actually hosting a fairly significant event based on maple sugaring.
Yeah, you know, at the end of March here, you know, and there's events all over town and all over the county. You know, Nature Center is really big on the maple sugar. And, you know, the one at Weir's the 29th and 30th, that last weekend in March. And bring the family out. There's going to be samples at these places. You can actually meet the trees, you know, and see the process. You could probably talk to those crusty old, you know, timers talking about the sugar shack. They'll be on hand as well.
And if you think you can actually get the tree's autograph, you really are a sap, right?
That's right.
Love it.
It sounds like a terrific way to spend an early spring afternoon or weekend. Ken, Stacy, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are our outdoor adventure contributors. They're also the creators of the website Destination Nature and authors of 2 books, the latest of which is We Love Nature, a keepsake journal for families who love to explore the outdoors. The event they mentioned, Maple Sugar Days, is Saturday and Sunday at the Weir Nature Center. While the slow spring might be good for maple syrup makers, it can't get going soon enough for Mequon residents Holly and Joey Baird. They have tray upon tray of sprouting onions, kale, and broccoli inside just waiting to go out. But that has not dampened the enthusiasm they share through videos on a website they call the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz visits Gardening and Video Central, the Baird's second floor flat in a former farmhouse.
There's more to pumpkins and pies and jack-o'-lanterns coming up on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener.
It all started with a gardening-related Facebook page and the video camera Holly Baird won at work.
So I won, and so we had this video camera, and we started with a Facebook page, which is Wisconsin Vegetable Gardeners, and people were asking us questions where we could, you know, we could find articles online or whatever to help them, but we figured we could actually show them now.
The Bairds produced their inaugural video, autumnal in theme, November 2011.
Welcome to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. I'm Joey Baird. This show is dedicated to the average gardener, simple home living, and using what you already have.
That's the voice of Holly's husband, Joey. What he lacked in documentary acumen, Joey made up for in enthusiasm and farming experience. He grew up and, until he and Holly teamed up, worked on the Baird family farm in southern Illinois.
About 1,000 tillable acres or so. Cattle, hogs, and grain was the operation there. And then we always had a garden. That was just part of life. With being on a farm, you have plenty of land, and that was just the way you saved money, by growing your own food, and that's what we did.
Holly grew up in West Allis, Wisconsin, growing vegetables at a much smaller scale.
4x4 plot where we basically just grew zucchini, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, and peas. And what's funny is that we would just put the seeds in the ground. And it wasn't until I met Joey that I learned that you can start the seeds ahead of time, or you can buy starts. We just, Memorial Day weekend, we just put the seeds in the ground and then we waited.
Joey says they were on equal footing when it came to ventures like a website, social media, and instructional videos.
Now, we have no background in videography, editing, nothing. So we went in this completely blind,
But, you know, knowing, you know, we've watched a lot of TV, we've watched a lot of videos, so we kind of knew what to do and what not to do to attract an audience.
How do you set that up to film yourselves?
First, we come up with a topic, and, you know, that really depends on what the weather's like. Nature's our schedule. So we'll plan we won't write a script, but we'll outline what we have. And we will actually, there's times where we've done hours of research just to make sure the information we're providing is adequate and correct. So when people watch our videos, even though they may only watch one for their whole lifetime, the information they're getting is correct.
Right. We actually usually get most of our research from University Extension websites.
Do you set aside a day or evening of the week that, okay, this is going to be our filming time, and you put on your makeup? And
We typically try to film, plan ahead and film on Saturday evenings. Typically, in the midst of summer, we'll put out 4 to 7 videos a week with different series. Tuesdays are normal, the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. Thursday is a new series that we're doing this year, First Garden, New Gardener, which takes you from the very basic, what is a garden, to we'll walk you all the way through to here's how you grow it, here's how you harvest it, and what you do with what you've harvested, as well as we're wrapping up our winter series, Growing Indoors, where we actually have tomatoes and green beans and lettuce ready to harvest that we've grown inside the house. And then there's other videos that we'll kick out throughout the week if we really come up with a hot topic.
Such as, what does it take to grow a thriving dwarf lime tree? The Bairds did just that next to their large kitchen window, along with baskets cascading with herbs. They also freely share failures and frustrations. Joey points to the remains of a winter experiment, hydroponics.
Hydroponics is the concept of growing plants in water. Hydroponics is soilless. Mm-hmm. There's no soil, so that really limits the possibility of, one, diseases, but two, whenever you grow in water, you have to have everything just precise because there's no microorganisms in the water. The water is the soil. So that has really gave us fits. That's one of the biggest challenges we've had this year.
Holly has mastered the art of canning and has won awards for it. Dozens of jars of varied sizes and colors line their pantry shelves.
Strawberry jam. Then there's some pumpkins, some pickles. I made like a pear chutney because we have a pear tree.
Your award-winning
pear
salsa.
Mm-hmm. And that's pickled Swiss chard.
Not as great as we thought it would be.
But it looks good.
It looks good, yeah.
And the Bairds may not repeat the pickled Swiss chard concoction, but they take their mission in educating viewers seriously, especially in the art of canning, where Joey says there is no room for error.
It's a science, and if you don't do it correctly, botulism is one of the pathogens that you can get from improper canning, and you don't come back from botulism, you die. So you've really got to follow the directions to the T. It's not something you can just half do and, okay, we'll be okay.
That from the heart earnestness remains as their videography skills become more polished.
These pepper plants are coming up nice. Now, a lot of people have difficulty getting their seeds to germinate, and this could be because the seeds and the soil are too cold.
The Bairds have also attracted several sponsors.
The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener is sponsored in part by...
And they've just released their first digital magazine. Still, their lives are not all showbiz. When the outdoor growing season finally does begin, the Bairds will be digging into multiple vegetable patches scattered across 3 counties.
One of them is my sister's family's. The other one is my friend and then her mother, and then she has 2 teenage daughters. The main one, which is at my mother's house, and then we have a small spot up here in the front.
We're looking at about 2,300 square feet in 4 different locations this year.
The 31-year-olds would like nothing more than to have their growing venture consume their professional lives, but don't see giving up their day jobs anytime soon.
We would like that, or at least a full-time job for one of us.
Mm-hmm. And right now the reward is the people that comments or emails us and goes, thank you for this, we appreciate this, you've shown us something we didn't know. And we're going to try it, or we did try it, and it was very successful. And without you doing it, we would have never known.
The Bairds seem to be casting a wide net. More than 3,000 individuals are regular followers, including people from far-flung Australia and South Africa to Turkey. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Holly and Joey Baird are the green thumb force behind the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. Susan Bentz visited them at their home base in Mequon. That's going to do it for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.